why social media was important to journalism, and then came back to the BBC and helped them write their social media strategy. What I've been doing recently is, with the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, we publish a whole load of reports on how people are consuming news, including this digital news report, which comes out every year. And I'm going to draw on some of the data in that as we go through this presentation. We poll in 26 countries, and it includes, we've been doing that in Japan as well as the UK since 2013. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on generally in terms of digital media, and then I'll talk about the impact that it's had on journalism, so sort of different strands of how it's affecting the world of journalism, journalists, and the spread and distribution of news. So the first thing is really to look at how the way in which we get our news has changed. So this is really looking at the UK and Japan, and looking at some of the main ways in which people get news. So television is the blue line, the red line is online, print and social media. And what you see in both Japan and the UK is that television and online now are vying in terms of number one and number two position. People are watching less television than they used to, and we're starting to see that fall. So particularly younger people are sitting down and watching television news bulletins much less than they used to. It's much harder for documentary programs, for example, to get an audience. But the main change that we've seen has been the decline of print. So the decline of print has been much more rapid in the UK, as you see, that's the green line, and the rise of social media as a way of discovering news. In fact, this is, are you using social media as a source of news? And in the UK, we now have around a third, so 36% now say social media, every week they're using social media as a way of discovering news, as a source of news. In Japan, slightly less, but still 21%, and I've just seen the data for 2016, and that's risen quite sharply. And then in terms of what do we mean by social media? Well, obviously we mean social networks, but what's interesting is that you're not always using the same mix of social networks depending on the country, and not to the same extent. So actually culturally we see enormous differences, with Japan at the bottom and Brazil at the top. So you see the Brazilians are unbelievably social in person, and they are also unbelievably social online. So 70% of them, for example, are using Facebook. Not just using Facebook, using Facebook for news, for finding news, discussing news in an average week. Japan, interestingly, is the only country where Facebook is, of the ones we look at, where Facebook is not the number one social network. It's actually YouTube, so more sort of visual network. And Twitter is more popular than Facebook. And we think this is because Japanese feel less comfortable at expressing themselves openly around politics in public. In fact, on Twitter, the Japanese use significantly fewer real names than people in other countries. And obviously Facebook is a network that demands that you use your real name. So that is changing, but we think that's one of the reasons for that. So different range of networks and different countries have embraced social media at different rates. This is just a list of the top social networks in each country for news. The British, by the way, also not particularly prolific in terms of social media. We're a little bit more Twitter heavy than many other countries. We use Facebook a little bit less, but that's again changing, moving more to Facebook. And they're the ones. Just worth mentioning that LINE is very significant in Japan, whereas here the messaging applications that are more used would be WhatsApp, for example. So again, we see some things which are common, like the use of Facebook, and some things which are different. So moving on to some of the ways in which social media has changed journalism and changed news. And obviously one of the most dramatic ways is the way in which news is broken. So increasingly people talk about news being broken through social media. And I guess citizen journalism emerged as a term in sort of the early 2000s, maybe the tsunami. People were taking pictures on their video phones. And then a whole succession, I think the 7/7 attacks in London was the first time that camera phone footage ended up at the top of the BBC television news, for example. That was in 2005. But those individual bits of personal media at that time didn't really have networks that then joined it up and allowed those citizens to distribute that media themselves. So what really changed was really the emergence of these networks, and particularly Twitter. This was the sort of famous photograph which kicked off, Eyewitness News on a huge scale. So this was a Danish guy called Janis Krums, I think he was Danish, who was on a ferry on the Hudson just as the plane came down. He was the first person to take the picture. And literally within seconds, that was around the world on Twitter in 2009 at the time that that network was taking off. And this was really the moment that journalists realized, because the official journalists from the New York Post and the New York Times took, you know, half an hour to get there. So basically, for the first time, social media had really scooped and delivered this news to people far, far more quickly. That was a real light bulb moment, I think. And then since that, we've just had a succession of events where now by default, almost the first place you go to find out what's happening when there's a really big story would be social media and Twitter, for example. So, for example, in the Paris attacks, I'm sure you've sort of seen many of these images. I suppose the difference now is it's not just text, it's not just still pictures, it's increasingly videos. So the video that of the French journalist, in fact, who was holding the iPhone out of his window taking pictures of the Bataclan, then you had somebody using Periscope, which is a new video network that only emerged last year, filming many of the same scenes, but essentially he was like a one-man 24-hour news channel. So you had 10,000 people coming in for his live stream at one stage, and there were three or four of these people streaming live. And then many people, of course, will have seen the explosions in the Stade de France, relayed by a 6-second clip of looping video through the social network Vine. Social networking and eyewitness news has become much more visual. All of these new tools have emerged which enable citizens not just to post pictures now, but to take videos as well. So some people are kind of calling this the growth of the video-enabled social networks, and I think it's genuinely true that when it comes to breaking news, that they're starting to rival 24-hour news as the most compelling and authentic destination for live news. So it's not no coincidence that live news channels such as Al Jazeera in the United States are closing down. Even the BBC is talking about merging or reducing its effort on live news, partly as a result of these trends. And the other thing, of course, which has emerged was this moment of soul searching for journalists. If citizens can do this eyewitness, then what's our job, you know? And increasingly, actually, it's interesting that journalists from traditional media organizations now see their role in these situations almost as verifying what is true and what isn't true, rather than breaking the news themselves. So a kind of good example of that was, and this, you know, speaks to the issue of balance that William was talking about earlier. The downside of social media is that, yes, it gives us access to things much more quickly and a huge range of things, but the question is, can you trust what you see? And can you trust it without the context that's provided by journalists? So, for example, the first one was an image that went around Twitter which showed the Eiffel Tower going dark. And everyone said, well, this has gone within an hour, this has gone dark, in sympathy with what's been happening. In fact, it goes dark every night. And so this was just a bit of mistruth, or it wasn't a particularly important one. But as you know, there were other things that were spread that night, including passports, allegedly, of someone who'd come in from Greece, which turned out not to be true much later. So traditionally, journalists would have sifted that, controlled that information, and only let it out to the public when they knew it was true. In social media, that stuff is just out there, and you have to deal with the consequences. This was where we've had Justin Bieber with cancer, I think. Nelson Mandela was killed many times before he actually died. This was one where Barack Obama was injured. This was actually the AP's official account that was hacked rather than anything else. And then this picture of Hurricane Sandy, which was a particularly ferocious storm that hit the US a couple of years ago. There were loads of pictures, including sharks in New York City. And this picture, actually, the cloud, which looks really impressive there above the Statue of Liberty, was from another storm in Oklahoma many years before that had been photoshopped on. So this whole question about, you know, what can you believe and what's the role of journalists, I think is a really interesting one, which we don't have any resolution to yet. The other thing, again, William just kind of referred to this really, I think, which is really interesting. So apart from Eyewitness News, I think that the networks have really enabled citizens to organise for themselves in new ways and much more powerful ways. So broadcast media was very much about delivering the world to individuals, broadcasting this sort of one-way trip, as Paul Sappho talks about it. Whereas personal media and the power of the networks that come along with it enable this two-way street. So it's not that everyone wants to talk back and have a conversation about every story, but it's the possibilities that exist and the implications of that that I think we're beginning to see. And that people now expect to be able to answer back, expect to be able to influence things in a way that weren't possible before. And William's already alluded to this example of many, many examples of how this works. So this was during the refugee crisis. Actually, the sort of sentiment towards positive sentiments towards refugees and their hardships really built up with hashtags like refugees welcome. And then the picture of the baby on the beach, who died on the beach in Turkey, which was flying around social media. It was a really horrific picture. And traditionally, newspapers would really, and television stations would not have published that picture. But it was out there in social media. And so there were lots and lots of discussions in newsrooms about what are we going to do with this. The Independent was one news organization that launched a petition and combined it with actually using that picture on the front page. And so really what we're seeing is actually, it's not social media itself or on its own, it's normally in conjunction with mainstream media. In this case, you know, the campaign was happening in social media and newspapers then amplify that. And the result of that is that David Cameron in the UK has to backtrack and insist that the UK were going to accept thousands of refugees, which a few days before he wasn't prepared to do. So that's a combination of the sentiment in social media amplified by the newspapers and those two things working together. So politicians, and again, this is a balance question for good and for ill, have to respond much more quickly. They have less time for reflection. I'm sure Andy will talk more about that later. It's one of the consequences of what we're seeing. The final thing I wanted to talk about is distribution and discovery. I sort of alluded to this already. So I think what's been really interesting is the combination of the mobile phone and the power in the mobile phone and these enormous global networks. And they really are enormous. I mean, 1.5 billion active users on Facebook a month, over a billion people using Facebook every day who are actively going and checking their news feeds. YouTube has over a billion, Twitter about 320 active users. And as we've seen, that's not the end of it. In the last few years, we've had a whole lot of other networks targeting at specific, much more visual networks quite often, niche networks. So Instagram for pictures and then video, Vine I mentioned already, Pinterest for pictures, Snapchat, ephemeral media. And then we've had the messaging applications. In many cases, these new messaging applications now becoming social, full-scale social networks in their own right. So WeChat, Line, Viber and all the rest of it. And what's that has enabled is individuals not just to create media, and indeed any of us to create media, but also to distribute it without having to rely on traditional media organisations. You can bypass those organisations and get extraordinary audiences. So just one example, this is actually a traditional media organisation, but it could be any piece of media that is compelling and resonates with people. This was an interview that was on Newsnight on BBC Two. I don't know, anybody have any idea how many people watch an average edition of Newsnight on a Tuesday night, roughly? It's about 400,000, yeah, now. So it used to be above that, 600,000. But this particular interview, which came from one of those broadcast got over 10 million on YouTube for a 17-minute interview with the comedian Russell Brand, because it really, really resonated, and people distributed and shared that themselves. So it found its audience through social media rather than traditional broadcast. So when you have, it just shows the power of these new distribution networks when you have content that is relevant and really resonates. And this is really what's been driving a lot of the new global media brands that we're seeing emerging. So BuzzFeed is a sort of classic. Jonah Peretti, who started BuzzFeed, talks about the various stages we've been through on the internet. So it used to be portals like Yahoo, and then it was search engines like Google that were in charge, and now he says it's moving to social, and social is the new starting point. In fact, of course, it's really a balance of all these things. It's not true that it's all going to social, but social is becoming far, far more important. And for some brands like BuzzFeed, 50% of their content now comes from mobile, 75% of their content comes from social media. It's actually higher than that now. It's data from a couple of years
ago. Say that again, Nick.
75% of all their traffic comes through social media. So the extent to which these new media brands are distributed, they're not relying on you going to their website or their mobile application. It's purely distributed through social media and through the power of these networks for discovery. And the other thing around discovery and the real sort of change that we've seen in the last year, we're going to see a lot more of this, is the rise of social video. So, you know, social networks were primarily around text originally, and then the last couple of years you started to see them fill up with pictures, and then increasingly it's filling up with videos. And YouTube, for example, 70% more watch time every year consumed, so videos within the YouTube network. But the real change has been Facebook. So over the last year, they've invested in video. Their strategy has been around video. They've just launched more live video, so a competitor to Periscope. And just between April last year and November last year, we went from 4 billion plays. That's four video plays for every Facebook user, to 8 billion plays within 6 months, so 100% increase. And they are relentlessly pushing more and more video. So this is a huge change, and it feeds into something that the media companies, again, going back to this question of balance between your own ability to have a direct relationship with a consumer and having to work through the power of platforms. So there's a huge debate going on within media companies at the moment about how to manage this move to distributed content, is what people are calling it. So you have, as more and more content is consumed within these social networks, within these platforms, we're seeing more opportunities for brands, but also more opportunities for platforms to make some money out of it and to get content that entices their customers. So Snapchat Discover is aimed at young people fundamentally, and it's an opportunity there for specific brands to publish content into it. Facebook Instant Articles is essentially saying we're going to reinvent what news articles are within our platform, within our view of how the internet should work, which may be very different from how news organizations think it should work. Apple News, come and just publish all your content with us. You don't need your own websites, and we'll help you with monetization. So this is a really interesting new trend. So just to recap, quite a lot going on. So more and more people are using social media as a source of news. You know, to William's point, yes, it is focused on the under 35s, but if you look at the profile for Facebook and LinkedIn, you know, it's pretty much now representative of the general population. So it's not true that it's just for the young, but it is still focused on the under 35s. In most countries we look at, with the exception of Japan, Facebook is by far the most important platform for news, for discovering news and distributing news. Social media, when it comes to breaking news, when it comes to stuff that's happening right now, is rivaling television as the number one destination for breaking news. Journalists depend on it for eyewitness news. Their contacts book, I used to have a physical contacts book, it's now electronic. It is Twitter, essentially, the electronic Rolodex. They use it for contact building. All the resistance we had 5 years ago has disappeared. I mean, people would not be without Twitter and their electronic Rolodexes anymore. And, you know, to the balance point, there are lots of upsides with this, and there are a number of downsides as well. It often contains information that is partial, it's lacking in context, often plain wrong, and increasingly the journalists are trying to address some of that. The networks themselves are trying to address it because the credibility and trust in the networks is also really important. And finally, that the shift to distributed news. So you haven't seen anything yet. And this sort of battle or this concern that publishers have right now, the dilemma, social networks are going to help them reach more people with more news, but publishers may lose direct relationships. So hopefully that was just a quick sort of skim through the world of social media from a journalistic perspective, and looking forward to your questions later on.
Thank you very much, Nick. I'd say that was sufficiently terrifying for you. I remember one of your events at the Reuters Institute, a well-known figure from old media saying to a well-known figure from new media, "You guys have got us over a barrel. You're going to put us out of business, aren't you?" I think what you said really illustrated that, and also that the cultural points, which I hope we'll come to later, because this is very much an international thing. And of course, the thing about social media, even more than regular media, it is no respecter of boundaries, so it is utterly global. And that's a very nice point on which to bring Andy, because his company is global, and the cultural elements come into play, and it's a matter of life or death for businesses, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, it is. What I would say is, as my introduction is, at Brunswick, we advise companies on how to manage their work, organisations, let's say, on how to manage their reputations in this environment that Nick has just described. And so I think the one of the things that I would say is my sort of intro, if you think it's all changing, it's a very noisy, disrupted, messy space in terms of where news is shared and reputation are played out. Just think how scary that is for an organization that is a historic legacy organization with communications and marketing verticals who are used to and staffed by people who are used to sort of 8-hour or one day news cycles, whereas now we're dealing with an expectation for sort of instant communications. That places huge levels of expectation and fear on the kind of organisations that we are talking to every day, because it's a different world, and it's not enough to just have a conversation with the journalists from the Financial Times or the Today programme. It's a much more messier situation. Now, did you just use a hard push, or is there a?
I just used a hard.
Okay, fine. So what I plan to do in this is sort of rattle through some of the big trends that we are seeing in terms of organisations and the challenges that they are facing and the kinds of things that they're doing differently to succeed and get their messages heard in this environment that Nick describes. And if I just sort of go through this, and apologies for people at the back if you can't read. The writing is a bit small, but the pressures facing communications from the C-suite, from the chief executives, right the way down to the organisations. Where we say the top left portfolio, reputation is touching on every part of a business now. Everybody in the world is a potential communicator or commentator, and so every part of a business is now has that understanding that it is customer facing potentially. So that's the first thing. Reputation touches everywhere. Media, as Nick has said, platforms have fractured and exploded. News organisations, and just to give you an example, Brunswick, we look after the Daily Mail, Trinity Mirror, and ITV, and the BBC, amongst some of our broadcasting clients. And this is absolutely something that we are hearing from them left, right, and centre. The growth is in the newer platforms. It's in the BuzzFeeds, Quartz, Business Insider, Forbes. These guys are hiring, but the traditional media organizations that we used to covet our relationships with, it's a sort of attrition and death by a thousand cuts in the newsrooms there, where they're sort of atrophying journalists who are becoming more time poor and less expert on the topics that they're covering. So the sort of expectation on us as the guardians of our clients' reputations is to educate continually the people that we're talking to and look for new ways to make sure that what they write is at least fair and accurate. Pace, as we've said, the real-time element of news. How do organisations, whether they're for-profit or whether they're not-for-profit organisations, how do they cope with this pace of news and the demand for them to be able to respond? And the other thing here, from an audience perspective, I would say since the crash of 2008, there is a marked shift in terms of attitudes towards business. There is a much higher level of general distrust towards anything that is said by our client base. That's just the nature of the beast. So within that, there is an expectation that organisations as a whole will be more transparent and will engage with audiences who ask questions of them, which itself places huge organisational challenges on organisations. And then as we go on here, within the organisations, where we say human capital, there is a lack of specialised talent. Very often you may be dealing from a media relations perspective with former journalists who still think in terms of getting press releases out to journalists who now don't read press releases, and the press releases on websites don't generally get written. They want to be pitched. Very often, I don't know whether you've noticed that, Nick, but journalists are very often saying, pitch me via Twitter. I don't want to read a long email. I want you to come to me through the channels where I'm being active at the moment. And then the other final thing is structural. We are seeing within the broad range of organisations that budgets and verticals within companies are sort of getting mashed together. And it's marketing and communications are working much more closely, sharing budgets so that the kind of things that they want to be doing, they could be using a sort of multiple parts from within a business. Internal communications, which used to be a very much sort of silo, is now switching towards external communications. There are great stories there that exist within companies, and increasingly they're starting to use those as an evidence of the kind of things going on within the company that they would like to tell the outside world. Now, this is a very, very messy world to try and manage your reputations through. So those are the pressures. What are the trends that we're seeing? I'll just sort of rattle through some of these and then talk through how companies are sort of are changing the way they communicate. The first one, the business pressures changing the media. That pretty much mirrors what Nick has said, that the growth is in the online digital first specialists who are coming with new business models like BuzzFeed. So they are looking at driving views via social and very much looking at paid, what we would call in my old journalistic days an advertising feature, sponsored or native content are phrases that are being used much more within news organisations like BuzzFeed, who will charge you something like £50,000 for a suite of three features, about eight, a BuzzFeed listicle, as we describe it, you know, eight reasons why your natural holiday destination is Spain. You know, that would be paid for by the Spanish Tourist Board, but it would appear there on BuzzFeed as a sort of pseudo editorial article. So the next piece, perishable content. The half-life of a post on Facebook, you will be getting about 75% of your readership within the first 3 hours. After that, forget it. It won't reach the audiences that you want to be getting to. The half-life of a tweet is about four times quicker than a post on Facebook. So within this sort of environment, we as PR advisors will work for weeks to get that piece in the newspaper for our clients. We work really hard, and so do they. And there it is; it appears on the on the website, but it's gone off the news, you know, off say the Telegraph. Within 72 hours, it sort of fritters down to the very bottom, and then the only way you'll ever find it is if you're on the site looking for that article, or if maybe it is appearing on Google searches. But that is a bit of luck, rather than intent very often. So how do you make sure that you get as much reach as possible in this environment where things disappear so quickly? Visual content. We've talked about video. we are seeing within our client base that increasingly they are spending a lot more money on creating video within the company and putting it up on their YouTube channels, increasingly through to Facebook as well. We are talking to our clients now about when they do have presentations, use Periscope, create Vine versions of the kind of content that they're creating. So very much matching and mirroring what's going on with audience expectations in the outside world. So that's what people will want, to how they will want to be consuming content. It's now up to an organization to create content that, that sort of washes its face and sits alongside that and bears comparison. Algorithms as the new editorial. The Associated Press has now started using machine intelligence and machine learning tools to automatically generate news content. It's easy around financial results, for instance, because you can sort of plug in the official statement, it can strip out the elements of the story, and it will automatically write that piece that will appear on the news wires. We're also seeing it with sports, so sports like baseball and cricket, for instance. Tennis is another one that can be used, that they can be using machine intelligence and algorithms to write those reports without the need of a human reporter to be doing that. Now, from our perspective, when it's a client's financial results, there isn't even a reporter to brief for this. It will just get written automatically. So that places even more of an onus on us to think, how can we navigate this where there isn't even a human who's writing the story? Interestingly, you mentioned the AP feed that got hacked. I mean, that knocked about $40 billion of value off the Dow Jones markets in the US. It recovered very quickly. But this was the automation is happening not only in the news space, but within automatic traders on the various stock indices. And this is something where there is a sort of direct financial impact on these kind of events that are happening. Organic reach. So this is the kind of content that you might be publishing on your Twitter feed or on your Facebook company page, for instance, or the brand feed. We're seeing increasingly low returns for the sort of owned channels that organisations, even up to sort of 6 months ago, would have felt intrinsically is enough. So we can put it on Twitter, at least it'll get out to people. You'll generally reach about 2% of your audience through that, which is tiny. A similar number for Facebook. Part of that is these are profit-making organisations. So it's in their interests to steer their clients towards the paid solutions and using sponsored posts and promoted tweets rather than it getting out organically onto people's timelines. And then two more here. The second screen in the boardroom is... There was, again, up until a couple of months ago, maybe a year ago, an expectation that the C-suite, the sort of senior executives, are still reading paper newspapers, reading the Financial Times. Increasingly, we're hearing it from our clients. They've all got devices and tablets and are actually looking at the content through that. You may be able to reach your CEO of a company that you want to get to through Facebook because they're looking at that in the evenings. So it's a definite sort of changing dynamic there in terms of how individuals are getting the media. And then finally, digital coming of age within the enterprise. So within the organisations that we are talking to, it's a case of the digital is now being used not just for communications, but actually the social business. So using digital communications to make the business more efficient, to collaborate across divisions. And that's something that we are finding is becoming increasingly used by organisations that are very hungry for cost-saving, efficiency improvements. And the internal channels, we didn't talk about enterprise networks like Yammer or Jive or Huddle, for instance, that are being used by organisations to talk internally and to collaborate better. So, those are the trends. Within that, we are finding that there are implications for organisations more broadly. The first one here, where we say pitch but publish, effectively go to the media and hope that they will cover you and feature you, but be aware that it will disappear very soon. They may not have a human writing it, and that human that writes it may well not necessarily get the end of the story that we would want to be want them to be using. So the point there is, organisations are increasingly creating their own content using their websites and pushing out through their various social channels. So pitch to the journalists, but also you are your own publishing channel, your own news creator. And organizations are investing a lot more budget, very often by hiring journalists who are being spat out of the news organizations to create content from within-side organizations. The other thing here, I wouldn't have expected to be saying this even 6 months ago about paid as standard. Within marketing divisions within organisations, yes, you would expect there to be budget accrued to advertising and to marketing. But we're now seeing this, that even for broader news-related and financial and earnings-related stories, that companies are now paying to make the most of some of the earned coverage that they're getting. And then the final thing, quants and creatives. Within this sort of digital environment where there is a lot of conversation going on, it is potentially measurable. So because you can measure, because you can have access to this data, it helps inform organizations when the time is right to say something, to engage, or indeed when the time might be right to say nothing. But that is it's an easy one. Where, for instance, there is a plane crash, and that it's big and it's all over the wires, and the news channels and the social networks. Then clearly, as an organisation, there is an onus on you to have something to say that has a bit of empathy, but also information and updates. But where there is a satirical news story or a satirical program on a TV network, does the company want to be involved with that one and engage? Actually, will it make things worse? But there are ways and means of making informed decisions about that. So those are some of the implications. Taking them, an example here, General Electric, GE, are very often sort of held up as being particularly good at this sort of approach about creating brilliant content that would stand very good comparison with some of the best stuff that we're seeing in online media. The point here was, this quote that we've got from Thomas Kellner was, initially the ethos behind it was that we want to have a platform where when the media gets it wrong, we can direct them to our side of the story. That was the crux of it at the beginning. But then they actually realized that, hang on, we have great stories going on within the organisation. We can use these as a proactive tool to supply and use with the networks. And very often an organisation like this is actually measuring itself on how much its content hub is getting cited by the media as an authoritative source for their news stories. We call this the boom and bust cycle of news. You work hard to get covered. This is the sort of old model, which is you get a sort of a mini spike when you get mentioned in The Guardian or in the BBC or Reuters, for instance. But afterwards, it just disappears because the article is gone and people have forgotten it. And so this is why we're now talking to a lot of our clients about the paid support point. So when you get that coverage, how are you making sure that you're making it work as hard as possible and get in front of these audiences who are very sort of time poor looking at their media across multiple channels? And this is where we're looking to get people towards, where it's a sort of cumulative approach, so that you get the pieces of coverage are then promoted so audiences are sustained beyond that 72 hours. Takes budget, that's the point. So for us, it's a case of explaining what the return is on that kind of investment. A good example of using paid here, we work on a lot of mergers and acquisitions and deals, some of them worth tens, often multiple tens of billions of dollars. In this case, and this is, by the way, very dry subject matter, but here we were working with a client, Syngenta, who are an agribusiness, crop science. Monsanto wanted to buy this organization. We actually didn't want to be bought. We thought that the price was too cheap. Actually, one of the key pieces of tools in our armory was a specific deal microsite that we built that was full of interesting content, principally video interviews, where we took a very editorial approach and used the content of those interviews to inform how we talked about it on social. For instance, the chairman in that video interview used the phrase, "They're trying to buy us on the cheap," which lends itself very well to the tweet, which then became the headline on Reuters, funnily enough, which was fantastic for us because Reuters gets very, very good traction on social, partly because the content is syndicated to so many news outlets around the world. But it does very well, so works from a search perspective. We use Google AdWords to promote this site. So we were actually marketing the website for people looking for search terms like Syngenta and Monsanto, the two companies involved, or indeed Syngenta and SharePrice. So looking to capture search traffic to drive those audiences to the location online where the content sat. The point here is you would normally expect there to be a very sort of brief spike in terms of audience interest. But in this case, as we say there, 10% of that traffic was coming through Google AdWords. Again, I wouldn't have expected to be doing that just 8 to 9 months ago, but the opportunity is there. Even around very sort of dry content. So this is an example from France. It's Ubisoft. So this is a case here where Yves Guillemot, the CEO, had a fantastic interview in Les Echos. We use Outbrain, so this is the sort of news syndication box that sits underneath articles on websites. You may see those when you're on news sites now. Underneath the article that you're reading, it would say, you may also be interested in these stories. Now, for this, we had a very good article that was explained the company strategy and through the eyes of the senior executive and the leader who was talking it. Well, we put about €10,000 of marketing budget to promote the story in these Outbrain boxes, which then translated into a lot more pickup of that positive article further down the line. And this is very much making the most of the fact that the story would disappear off the Les Echos website within 72 hours. Now, the final piece is this point about data-informed decisions. As we say, a really good quote here from Brian Solis, I'll read it for the people at the back. If you're a business, the takeaway is that sharing without analytics is essentially useless. That engagement is not as valuable as insight, and that seeing things in context is more important than being popular. And then on the other side, we've got a quote from the McKinsey Quarterly here, which is, even as marketing reaches new heights with technology-enabled measurement, the importance of the story still hasn't diminished, but ways to tell it are morphing as the stuff of storytelling encompasses richer digital interactions. So within this space, we are advising and talking to our clients about how you can still be creating the content, but use the data and the insights from the audiences that you're seeing to tell you exactly sort of how to approach it. And two examples here. When I talk about the use of algorithms to write news stories, one thing that they can't change is content that is created by you. So in this case, when Pepsi had their financial results, we did an infographic around this. And we used that, funnily enough, we gave it to BuzzFeed, who drove an awful lot of traffic for this piece of content through their various sort of social pickups. As we say here, I think it was sort of an engagement rate 5 times higher than their best performing tweet in 2014 because it was picked up by BuzzFeed. But the point here is that gets embedded into a story, even if it is written by an algorithm, they can't change that content. So this is something that you own and is then embedded into the piece. By the way, even for something like a deal microsite, we have very good analytics on the pieces of content that are downloaded. Invariably, it's not the press release, it's not the swanky prospectus, it's the infographic, which is the most important thing, or the most popular thing that's downloaded the most. That's what there is a real sort of appetite for. And then finally, you may not see John Oliver's Last Week Today show in the US. It's a very satirical, a bit like Have I Got News For You in this country, a bit like The Daily Show. We were working with Gap at the time, and there was a expectation that there might be a piece on this show relating to working practices overseas, which, you know, for the garment industry is a big issue. This was a question that was asked: do we need to engage in whatever happens around this show, or don't we? And this was a case of where we could use Twitter analytics to inform whether or not it was the right time to do something. And it's hard to pick up here, but what we actually were able to do was model recent broadcasts and model the pickup around and social around the TV broadcast itself. And you can see, if I just point to this, this is the point, and we took the last sort of three shows and were able to say, hang on, what actually do people do when they're talking about this? So this is as the piece is actually going live and broadcast. This is the moment where it goes up on YouTube later on, and then it picks up later on during the... Sorry, no, this is the live show, this is YouTube, and this is the news coverage the next morning, where generally the sort of top lines from the show are picked up and then there's a bit of news coverage around it, but then it fritters away. In this case... We were able to say, look, the conversation is actually satirical that's going online. It's not really about you. It's about other organisations. And the volume of commentary about this is much lower than for the last three shows. So you don't need to raise your head above the parapet now. You don't need to engage in this. It will do this here, and it will disappear and fritter away. So you don't need to worry about engaging in this a potentially sensitive issue for now.
Andy, are you winding down?
That's my last slide, you'll be pleased to know. There you go. So thank you very much. Happy to take questions later on.
So another example of transformational effects, and a lot of us old business models, journalists no longer needed, new ones taking their place. We're now going to ask Masayuki to talk about things from a Japanese perspective, and his perspective having done a lot of international reporting. But I think that the cultural aspect is very interesting here. You didn't mention, Andy, the examples later. We're going to ask you to call on some of the different corporate personalities that are shown through the dealings with the media and social media. But if I may say so, Masa, the Japanese media, this is often a theme in here at Daiwa, have very strong distinctive features. Some people in this part of the world regard Japanese mainstream media as somewhat deferential. That's to say they're not challenging of authority and the government compared to the ones here. But we want to know what has happened with the arrival of social media. Has it made the country, the society, more questioning? Has it, on the contrary, helped the government? Now you have a so-called right-wing government in Japan, and whatever else you want to say. Please. Thank you very much.
Good evening. Okay. And first of all, I have to say, I have to tell you that, beforehand, I'm not a specialist of the so-called social media, and now I'm not a full-time journalist, but rather house husband. So I prefer talking about the cooking problem in the UK to dealing with the relationship and the Japanese political situation and the social media. Anyway, furthermore, even when I worked as a staff writer for DigiPress, my main coverage was on the economic area, but not in the political areas. Anyway, but so I'm sorry for you, but anyway, I try to express what I'm thinking of this relevant issue. In the beginning, yes, I have to say maybe that it's better to, I will come up with my conclusion, my remarks. And social media in Japan are very influential that their impact now looks like helping to keep the biggest party, LDP, Liberal Democratic Party, Jiminto, in power forever. It seems to me that the LDP, especially Prime Minister Abe, knows very well the power of the social media and use them to attack the existence mass media. Existence mass media is often supporter of the minor parties, so they hate something. Mr. Abe looks like hating. To make you understand this awful reality, yes, please allow me to talk about my own coverage story. The only Japanese MP, political person I knew well personally was the late Mr. Shoichi Nakagawa. He was one of the next leaders of LDP, but he died in 2009, age 56, due to illness. But we know he was almost alcoholic and depressed physically and mentally after having lost the MP seat in the general election 2 months before. I covered Mr. Nakagawa as Minister of Agriculture. His first tenure, 1998 to 99. Later, he got to be known as hardliner hawkish politician, not only for China and Korea, but also for mass media as well. But at my coverage time of him, he was much more milder and tried to keep friendly relationship with journalists. After his leaving the minister post, I kept contact with him because we were both got involved in the Doha round, WTO negotiations, especially when I was a correspondent in Geneva. I recalled that Mr. Nakagawa mentioned often his father, Nakagawa Ichiro. He was very famous hardliner politician leader, and he was a minister of agriculture as well. But he committed suicide in mysterious situation. And Mr. Shoichi Nakagawa was the best friend of Prime Minister Abe. At that time, he is not the Prime Minister. But they have a similar background. The both have grown in a very famous families in the political world and had a kind of inferior complex for their father or grandfather. To overcome this complex, they had to be more hawkish than their notable family members. That's their obsession from their childhood. So sometimes they were apparently very aggressive towards media. In 2005, Asahi Shimbun, a very famous Japanese newspaper, reported that in 2001, Abe and Nakagawa both gave pressure to NHK, NHK's National Broadcast Center, like BBC, pressure not to broadcast a program about the comfort women in Korea. This raised serious concerns about the independence of Japanese leading media, especially NHK, which is a national public broadcasting station. Now, Mr. Abe is a prime minister for the second time and enjoys a long period of reign. He seems to still hate the existence press media, and now too he seems to feel the sympathy with the social media, especially so-called right-wing radical supporters on the cyberspace. They called in Japanese Neto Uyo. It means that the abbreviation of the network, Uyok, right-wing. Generally speaking, almost all Japanese media try to report from the neutral position. So there had been always a certain number of people who were not satisfied with such an ambiguous type of report. That means that people from right and left, both extremist side, before they don't find a way to express their opinions in public. But now, with social media, they can openly attack the existing media as too generous or too naive in front of the delicate issues. in Japan, we almost never have had a two big party system, even if it's a kind of a precondition for the change of government. And now it seems that social media's power helps the majority party stay perpetually in the government. The Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, successfully used the social media with not trying to contain the radical right's wing opinions and stir up the hostilities against the neighbor countries, South Korea and China. And as for the mass media, Abe's government is always ready to intervene when inconvenient reports for them come up. Recently, some TV presenters regarded as in the left-wing side had to leave their program. We guess there should be some pressure from government side. Of course, social media are often used by the left-wing activists, but their power is always dispersed. And often, their opinions are considered as ideological and not realistic. Even worse, the main left-wing party, Democratic Party, Minshuto, has lost the confidence of voters in the catastrophic failure of its recent ruling. For the relationship between the Japanese foreign policy and social media, we have a very interesting example. As you know, between Japan and China, there is a territorial conflict about a small island called Senkaku. In Chinese, Diaoyu exists. And in 2010, a grave incident broke up. A Chinese fisher boat operating in disputed waters collided with Japanese Coast Guard patrol boats. The scene was filmed by Japanese Coast Guard, and just a few MPs, political persons, watched the footage, but not open to the public. But the footage was leaked by an employee of Japanese Coast Guard, and this had a very dramatic effect to weaken Chinese government's protest. Because with this footage, it comes to be very clear that the Chinese fishery boat was very aggressive. We guess that the Democratic Party, at that time the major party, might consider too much Chinese reaction, but we're not sure. Anyway, we can say one thing very clearly, that the Democratic Party didn't realize it's almost impossible to hide such important evidence if once its existence was confirmed. And the social media have a large influence to form the opinions, public opinions. Compared to previous Japanese government, China has been very active in this area. And in 2010, at the moment of the Senkaku conflict, Chinese hacker group Huangku hacked the Japanese government website, including the Ministry of Defense. Most people think this group had some connection with Chinese authority. Now, in Japan, Abe's government knows very well social media's power as well and try to use them for its benefit. At the end of the year, Japan and South Korea reached agreement to solve the problem of comfort women during the Second World War. But right-wing activists were not happy with this result, pretending it's a product of the compromise and expressed severe complaints in the social media. It said that Mr. Abe is very concerned about such complaints on the social media, and for the next stage of a highly political issue, it means a revise of the Japanese constitutional law, he will keep the hardline policy to please his supporters. So it's a current situation of the social media in Japan and political world. There is not a bright outlook, but it's a reality. And at the end, already Nick has explained that the general situation of the social media. So I prepared a repeat, but I talk about the a little bit different type of the media, social media. Do you know the Nichannel? Mm-hmm. Nichannel is not really social media, but a kind of the, it's translated like a text board. It's a kind of the place we can write anything you want, anything they want.
It's like but a
yes, yes,
with bulletin board.
Yeah, but yeah, without censure. So that using this a kind of a social media, that network that I mentioned before, that right-wing radical persons very active on the social media, but and another thing that yes, it is similar to that phenomenon, but very characteristic phenomenon in Japanese social media, it's an enjo. Do you know? Enjo is translated in English as a flaming or under fire. It means that a certain number of the net users attack a person who expresses an opinion that doesn't please them by writing very insulting phrases, words, and sometimes enforced to shut down the relevant site. It shows that the aggressiveness of the Japanese anonymous net users in closed circle. Maybe that they were suppressed and unhappy in ordinary life, but it's a kind of the reaction of them. Thank you very much for your hearing.
Very, very much. Well, you've been very patient, but we want to hear your questions and points. I think what Masa said just reinforces what was said earlier about the fantastic speeding up and amplifying effect of everything through social media, new media, but also social media, life and death, winners and losers in every department of affairs that we have been discussing this evening.